Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting the U.S. could have carried out a deadly airstrike on a hospital in Afghanistan. An airstrike in northern Afghanistan has killed at least 19 people, including three children, at a hospital run by Doctors Without Borders, according to the charity group, also known as MSF. 12 staff members are among the dead at the hospital in Kunduz after what the medical group described as a sustained bombing that continued for more than 30 minutes after American and Afghan military officials in Kabul and Washington were first informed of the airstrikes. The U.S. military has acknowledged it conducted a pre-dawn airstrike in the area that may have caused collateral damage to the medical facility. A spokesman for U.S. forces in Afghanistan, Colonel Brian Trebus, says that individuals threatening the force were the target of the strike. The U.S. Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, offered his thoughts and prayers to everyone affected in a statement. A full investigation into the tragic incident, he says, is underway in coordination with the Afghan government, according to Carter. The International Committee of the Red Cross in Afghanistan strongly condemned the attack. A spokesman for the committee, Nicholas Metry, told VOA that ICRC was very shocked and saddened by the tragic news.
And to hear that it was bombed and many of our MSF friends were killed, it's absolutely tragic and very, very shocking news for us.
Earlier, Doctors Without Borders said in a statement that MSF condemns in the strongest possible terms the horrific bombing of its hospital in Kunduz, full of staff and patients, and that all parties, including Kabul and Washington, were clearly informed of the precise location. GPS and several bombs in two locations of the Nigerian capital, Abuja, killed at least 15 people. That according to the National Emergency Management Agency. This is VOA News. The explosions Friday night were in Nyanya and Kuji suburbs of Abuja, agency spokesman Sani Dati said in a statement. He said 13 people died in the blast in Kuji and two in Nyanya. At least 41 people were wounded, he said. No group has claimed responsibility, but the attack is similar to others by Boko Haram, Nigeria's homegrown Islamic extremist group. Boko Haram has largely been carrying out attacks in the country's northeast, but has been extending its range to other cities. Violence from Boko Haram's six-year insurgency has killed nearly 20,000 people and displaced 1.4 million from their homes. At least 1,000 people have been killed since President Muhammadu Buhari took office earlier this year with the promise of wiping out the insurgents. The UK's defense secretary estimates only 5% of Russia's airstrikes in Syria have targeted Islamic State extremists. In an interview with the Sun newspaper, Michael Fallon said most of the Russian bombs have instead targeted other Syrian rebel groups, including the Western-backed Syrian Free Army, and were killing civilians. Fallon said, "We're amazed where the strikes are going every morning. The vast majority are not against IS at all." He says our evidence indicates they're dropping unguided munitions in civilian areas, killing civilians, and they're dropping them against Free Syrian forces fighting Assad. The Russian army said Saturday the Russian Air Force conducted more than 60 flights over 72 hours targeting more than 50 Islamic State facilities in Syria. The U.S.-led coalition Friday urged Moscow to halt any attacks on the Syrian opposition and focus on Islamic State targets. Hungary's foreign minister Saturday said the global migration crisis had reached levels that could threaten the stability of the European Union in the long run, and reiterated a call he made earlier this week for the EU to take over the funding of refugee camps in Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. Peter Sierto issued the warning in a speech to the United Nations General Assembly in New York.
Regarding the size, this mass migration is a mass migration with unlimited source of supply of people. And if we cannot stop the influx shortly, then this challenge will stay with us for a long time.
Meanwhile, more than 100 migrants stormed the Chunnel Tunnel early Saturday, penetrating a third of the way through in an incident which halted traffic overnight. I'm Ira Melman, VOA News, Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Simpuga. Peter Clote is on assignment.
Preferably, elections don't simply take place, but they are free and democratic. They happen in the context of freedom of assembly and speech, absent coercion, corruption, and violence.
Pro-democracy activists call for continued support for civil society and election monitoring groups in Africa.
If you're not able to provide jobs and opportunities for them in the future, it's a social, it's a ticking bomb. We need 60% more food on this planet within the next 4 to 5 years.
Scientists say demographic changes are affecting rising population growth, urbanization, and land reform.
These are goals on development, on health, education, poverty reduction that were adopted by the world's leaders in the year 2000.
And we take a look at the discussions at the United Nations General Assembly to end poverty, foster development, and promote health for all people. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. But first, in Central African Republic, where the interim president, Catherine Samba Panza, announced the postponement of a presidential election following renewed violence that left dozens of people dead in the capital, Bangui. At least 36 people have reportedly been killed and 100 injured. My colleague John Tanza reached the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, and asked her what the international community is doing to calm the situation.
What I'm hearing from the leaders I met with, and I had a number of very productive meetings, including with President Samba Panza, is that there continues to be strong support for her efforts to move forward on elections. And we have all called for an end to the violence. The people of Carr have spoken, and they indicated their desire to have elections by 1.5 million people registering to vote. And we need to allow them to register to vote. So we have called on those who are involved in or inciting violence, including some of the leaders from the anti-Balaka militia and the Seleka, as well as some of those former government officials, that they must cease fomenting violence, they must be held accountable for their actions, and they must allow the people of Central African Republic to have their say at the voting booths.
And how about efforts to address problems internally? Because right after the instability in Central Africa, it looks like the conflict went into sectarian angle. Is there any efforts the U.S. government is doing to bring people of Central Africa together to sit and dialogue on the issues that they differ on?
Absolutely. There have been a number of dialogues. We have brought religious leaders from the United States, from both the Christian community as well as the Islamic community, to work with the two parties. We brought leaders from both of those communities to the United States, so that they had an opportunity to talk to our leaders, but look for support. And we have supported a dialogue that took place in the country that led to how the election would be conducted. And these have gone very, very well. Unfortunately, it is those people who do not want to see this country have elections, who are not prepared to allow the people of Central Africa Republic to have peace, who are interfering with this process, and we call upon them to cease and desist from their efforts. They will be held accountable.
That was Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She spoke from New York with my colleague John Tanza. Pro-democracy activists have urged continued support for civil society and election monitoring groups in Africa. They say that democratic forces must keep up with some of the more sophisticated and legalistic ways used by authoritarian governments to stay in power. From Washington, reporter William Eagle reports on a recent roundtable discussion on elections and governance in Africa. It was held by the Constituency for Africa, the National Democratic Institute, and the National Endowment for Democracy.
In the next few months, African voters will go to the polls in several countries, including Tanzania, Ivory Coast, Guinea, and the Central African Republic.
Preferably, elections don't simply take place, but they are free and democratic. They happen in the context of freedom of assembly and speech, absent coercion, corruption, and violence. They actually express the will of the people, not the power of a privileged elite.
Dave Peterson is the Africa director of the Washington-based National Endowment for Democracy. He says free and fair elections should include transparency, accountability, and good governance. But that's not always the case. Peterson says voters in Nigeria and Senegal regularly go to the polls, though he says some argue that the two are not particularly well-governed. On the other hand, he says, many development specialists say Ethiopia and Rwanda are well-governed, though their rulers do not tolerate dissent, and the opposition has little or no public presence. He says the goal of his and other pro-democracy groups is to increase the amount of democratic participation in the elections. That's not easy. Observers say there are competing pressures between pro-democracy reformers and governments exercising new ways to maintain power. Jennifer Cook is the Africa director for the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. She says authoritarian regimes are using subtle and legalistic ways to defeat opponents. They include strict media regulations, broadly interpreted security laws, and a crackdown on pro-democracy NGOs that receive foreign funding. Some use the democratically elected legislature or courts to enact constitutional reforms to remove presidential term limits. When confronted with the declining popularity of its long-serving ruler, pro-government reformers in Angola ensured that the president would no longer be elected by direct vote, but by the majority party in parliament.
Even in places like Tanzania, that has so long been kind of the donor darling because it's kind of safe and inoffensive, you've seen and has every single U.S. assistance program pretty much there. You've seen media laws recently that are very troubling. You've seen laws on cybersecurity that allow police to go in and seize computers without much justification. Even laws like the law on statistics that says no statistics may be published unless they are approved by the government. And that is a fundamental challenge to accountable governance and democratic practice.
Pro-democracy groups have their own means of fighting back, including new technologies. Cook says in 2008, Zimbabwe's opposition was able to assert it had won elections with photos of the polling results. In Nigeria's recent polls, social media was used to educate voters on their rights and responsibilities and to monitor the elections. In some regions, pro-democracy NGOs now work across borders, while urbanization and economic advances are creating a more assertive middle class that wants its say in politics.
Rising expectations on the part of African citizens, demands and pressure for democracy from young, more urban populations, economic growth and investment, even though it's been uneven across the continent, has meant that many of those who were kind of formerly in bare subsistence now are part of the consuming, if not middle class, and are able to exert more political pressure and have more time to do that.
Democracy activists say civil society, African regional groups like the Economic Community of West African States, and the international community at large all need to push back against authoritarian rule. Activists say diaspora groups in the U.S. can play a role in influencing U.S. policy and add to the pressure to open up restrictive regimes. And pro-democracy groups like the National Democratic Institute and International Republican Institute should continue to provide technical assistance to ensure free and fair elections. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
In Malawi, a study by University of Maryland School of Medicine researcher has found major lack of resources for patients at the country's only free inpatient rehabilitation center. VOA's Lamek Masina visited the facility in Blantyre and has this report.
A 20-year-old Stella Bottoman suffered a general body weakness in January, 2 weeks before she graduated as a Malawi prison warden.
That was on 3rd January when I just woke up in the morning and I was not able to wake up myself, to stand. I was able to use my hands. Everything was down, like a general body weakness.
Bottoman says the condition dashed her hope of getting employment. But she says a ray of hope came when doctors at Zomba Central Hospital recommended her for physical therapy at Kajera Rehabilitation Center in Blantyre.
I came here on 9 April. That time I was not able to do anything by myself. But now there are much improvement because at the meantime I'm able to walk, at least with a walker, the starting point of walking here.
Eunice Tekere is another patient admitted at the center from Southern District of Cholo. She had been paralyzed by a stroke. She's now feeling well and is waiting for a word from doctors as to when to return home. Hetekere and Bottoman are just two of thousands of patients who have benefited from the rehabilitation services offered at the center, which opened in 1995. It offers free services to individuals with stroke, spinal cord injury, and similar conditions. However, a recent study by the University of Maryland School of Medicine researcher Dr. Leslie Griegman says despite the good work, inadequate funding is preventing the center from operating more effectively. General Manager for the Rehabilitation Center, Sidney Ndembe, confirms the study findings.
This place is partially funded by government. But you know what government is like. Government has got too many commitments. Say, who would need something like at this? 144 million for a year, but they give you 90 million.
That lack of money also means a lack of equipment needed by physiotherapists like Veronica Mowo. She works in the center's gym.
When we are doing strength and exercise, we need to use equipment. Some of them we have, but they are not enough, depending on the number of therapists which we have. For instance, here in this gym, we are almost 8, and maybe some of the equipment is just only 1. So 8 therapists fighting for 1 equipment.
The study, which was recently published in the Journal of Global Health, also said there are essentially no follow-up services for patients after they return to their families, homes, and communities. It says this has resulted in the discharged patients face a range of obstacles that make it harder to find employment or move freely throughout society. For example, some patients need home visits by a physical therapist or disability-friendly draw entrances, chairs, and walking aids. Isaac Chabwetek is the head of inpatient section at the center.
Before the patient is being discharged, we really need to visit the place where he stays so that when he goes home, he doesn't have another stress. That used to happen before, but currently because of problems with funding.
The study says the center should still find ways to improve on follow-up care. Chabweteka also says the facility has only 40 beds, not enough for increasing number of patients which seek helping from the facility.
We end up telling them to wait. By telling them to wait, we have a problem in such a way that they develop other complications instead of just coming here straight. And we are really looking for assistance such as increasing the bed capacity, whereby we need to increase the space for the beds as well as the gym.
But despite the challenges, Ndembe says he foresees things changing for the better, citing a number of well-wishers he says are showing interest to start contributing towards the noble duty the organization is doing in the country. Already some have built bathrooms and provided food for the center. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Scientists say demographic changes are affecting rising population growth, urbanizations, and land reform. They urge the private sector to boost food production. But opponents have made a stand in Africa, and now poor smallholder farmers in remote parts of Tanzania are in the middle of a global ideological war over land ownership. From Dar es Salaam, Ruben Chama reports.
Eco Energy is among several transnational corporations that have come to invest in large-scale agriculture in the East African nation through a public-private partnership initiative. The initiative, called the Southern Agricultural Corridor of Tanzania, SAGOT, is being implemented in an area covering the size of Italy. It's part of the G7's new Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, which aims to generate greater private investment for agriculture, scale up innovation, achieve sustainable food security, and reduce poverty and end hunger. Carsten, the executive chairman of Eco Energy, says time has come for Tanzania, a country of 53 million people, to transform its agriculture to create jobs and support economic growth before a crisis hits.
If the population expects to grow more than 2.5 times in the next 40 years in Africa, Tanzania, where we are now, it expects to grow 3 times. A lot of things you see here in Tanzania, how to handle land, for example, is based on when there were 15 million people, like in the mid-60s and the late 60s. If you're not able to provide jobs and opportunities for them in the future, it's a social, it's a ticking bomb. We need 60% more food on this planet within the next 4 or 5 years.
He said that Africa, the world's poorest continent, needed to borrow a leaf from Brazil, the world's largest exporter of sugar, after it transformed its agriculture sector to large-scale farming.
I lived 4 years in Brazil, and you see in the latitude, these are the same natural conditions. The question is, how come can Africa be the biggest importer of sugar and ethanol and fuel, while if you take Brazil, it's exporting 50% of the world supply.
But now poor smallholder farmers are siding with opponents to corporate investment in large-scale agriculture. For example, the Swedish-owned company plans to set up a sugarcane plantation in Razaba village in northeastern Tanzania's Bagamoyo district. But there is a simmering standoff resulting to unending discussions around compensation. As a result, the project is 4 years late in getting started. Although Eco Energy has consulted villagers in Bagamoyo, a recent study by ActionAid refused that majority of the local small-scale farmers have not been offered choice of whether to be resettled or not. The report alleges that they have also not been given crucial information about the irreversible effects of the project on their livelihoods and food sovereignty. Local farmers, too, agreed with the sentiments raised by the ActionAid report and expressed fear of a loss of prime land and failure by the authorities to engage them in the process. Nawahi, a 59-year-old father of four, said the confusion surrounding the land acquisition process has disrupted the normal way of life among the local farmers. A lot of the food crops and produce have dried up. There is nothing here. Here, we used to have citrus fruits, guavas, and they themselves saw that. Nawahi used to cultivate maize, beans, pawpaws, cassava, and vegetables in 4 out of his 6 acre piece of land. Tanzanian officials clarified that the Bagamoyo project is a special case, and that the land belonged to the government. Dr. Moses Kusiluka, the commissioner for lands, said the site was initially earmarked as a ranch for livestock keeping before it was abandoned.
The Eco Energy Farm in Bagamoyo is a farm that is owned by the government. It has a title deed. It belongs to the government. So that's not village land.
Amid the uncertainties that have hampered the implementation of the Bagamoyo sugarcane plantation project, a group of smallholder farmers in Morogoro, some 170 kilometers west of Dar es Salaam, have offered a ray of hope. They have adopted eco-friendly farming practices that promise higher yields and income. Reporting for VOA News, this is Ruben Chama from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
And at the United Nations 70th General Assembly in New York, many eyes are on the Sustainable Development Goals that have replaced the Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs, that expired this year. The ambitious goals for both projects are the same, that's to end poverty, foster development, and promote health for all people. No single UN organization bears more responsibility for achieving those goals than the World Health Organization. To find out more about lessons learned and the path forward, VOA's New York correspondent Adam Phillips spoke with Mashidisho Moete, the WHO's new regional director for Africa.
I'm very excited by this moment. We've looked forward to 2015, the Millennium Development Goals. These are goals on development, on health, education, poverty reduction that were adopted by the world's leaders in the year 2000 in order to speed up improving people's lives all over the world, particularly people living in poor countries. What did we manage to achieve from the perspective of Africa, where I come from? They did make some progress, not as much as had been hoped for in reducing child deaths, in improving the number of years people live, life expectancy, despite having gone through a very bad HIV epidemic in the African region at this time. But we learned many lessons as well, I believe, and those will stand us in good stead going forward with the new goals, the so-called sustainable development goals that are going to be adopted by the world at this meeting here in New York.
What did you learn? Just tell me, sort of in a nutshell, a few of the lessons that you learned, sort of in a sentence each.
First, it's very important to pay attention to equity and not to assume that if you have a good program and you fund it well, everybody will benefit from it equally.
By equity, do you mean equality?
I mean a fair access by all people in different circumstances of life to opportunities and services to, in this case, improve their health. That was one thing which I think is going to be important going forward. And WHO has a strategy called universal health coverage, where we are going to try and address equity in health for people who can pay and for people who can't pay to make sure that they have access to health services. That's one. Secondly, I think we learned a lot about what other sectors like education, like trade, like water and sanitation, like the environment have on health. And we know now that even if the Ministry of Health is brilliant and fabulous, they won't be able to get it done on their own. What's happening in other spheres of life affects health. Thirdly, participation of people. We learned, and we've learned latterly, especially in this Ebola outbreak, but we've learned also in other areas of health that we can go along a certain way if it's government declaring, deciding what to do, and then providing services. People have to take an active part in improving their own health, and they have to be enabled, given the opportunities, given the means to do that. I believe this stands a much better chance of helping people take an active part in improving their own health, in making sure their children go to school, for example, in making sure their young girls are protected in certain ways that will help them to be developed and to contribute to development in their countries. I think these are some of the things we need to pay more attention to.
Since it's such a challenge to be able to shift the culture around and get health ministers and other people, including grassroots people, to begin to take an active hand in their own health education, what is it you're actually trying to overcome? Why is it difficult to do that?
That's an interesting question. I think it's the way societies are organized, fundamentally. And particularly, it's the traditional way that governments have tended to organize their programs on development. Some well-meaning people who want progress to happen get together, propose an approach, identify needs that need to be filled, and define ways to go about doing that without going to the people involved to say, how do you see this? What do you think will happen? And I must say, I mean, with some experience in this, sometimes what discourages people is that you may get the answer that you don't want. It may be that people have other priorities from what you see as important and may have other preoccupations which you then need to take into account. But I think we need to have the courage to do this, to listen, to understand and take this into account, because at the end of the day, you can only do so much for people. People need to do things for themselves and need to believe in what is being done for them and with them in order to take part in it effectively.
That was Dr. Mashidisho Moete, the United Nations World Health Organization New Region Director for Africa. She spoke with our correspondent, Adam Phillips, in New York. This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the program, our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Yes, now it's time for our Saturday music spot, and for that, just sit down, relax, and enjoy some great music from the continent.
Super diva, ten over ten, jambore. Super mama,
Ferrari, super radiant, oh, incredible.
I will make you feel alright. I will love you till you go be like coffee. It's alright. We go jambori. We go dance in shokori. You dey feel my melody. Oh yeah, make we go limbobo. Eh. Oh yeah, jambori. Jambori. You dey feel my melody. Oh yeah, make we go limbobo. Eh.
Oh my lover.
Jambori. Oh my lover, hey my lover, oh my lover, in a waka misi.
My lover, got to walk on Miranda, oh, fashion Nikita, ha, say,
no worry baby. I give to you everything you need. You know go suffer, we go jolly. I get you plenty, plenty money. From Kampala, take you to Lagos, anywhere you want go. Eddie Kenzo, KC, flexing and shopping, baby, come on, let's go.
Holy, shake it, roll in my baby, move it. Holy, shake it, roll in my baby, move it.
Hey, my lady, yo, taba some best way. Oh, no, wanga susekal. Maswaka swaka ngabi ya sekai. Ono wanga susekali. Hapana na Kimu Kardashian.
Hey.
Oh my lover.
Jambore.
Ah,
Wakabi.
Hey my lover.
Jambore.
Oh,
Wakabi.
Oh my lover.
Jambore.
Hey my lover.
Wakabi.
Oh my lover.
Jambore.
Ina wakamisi.
Wakabi.
Hey my leyo.
Jambore.
Taba sampesu.
Wakabi.
Yeah.
To Lagos, I gon' make you famous, even if they made us.
Tanzania to Lagos. Chako kwangu maradhi matuso none kapo kwangu simanzi ai tatu kidonda chako kwangu maradhi oh yani sonone kapo kwangu simanzi kwa mahaba ulonipa nimenogewa vurugu patashika ai punguza kidogo na mengine kadhalika toto si unanielewa hapo hapo liposhika
Soleda, fish no get fed up. Love we a get no get wet up. Kaki no soleda, fish no get fed up. The love we a get no get wet up. Oh na 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 na. Nega don't know you. They got some for all the lovers out there. Nada. Baby, picture me and you. But I know the past, so I can't live a moment without you. Now one day I do. It can is not easy, but I know it's impossible. For me, for plan, oh. Only you. Oh, yeah. Take bullets for you, me, I know they fade you.
Tell you what, tell you what.
Talk to the news and all over the radio. Tell only one, yo. Say me too, a beautiful girl like you, need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Like me, a beautiful girl like you, need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Like me, because I'm not a leader. Fish no get better. In love way I get no get weather. No get weather. So, I'm not a leader. Fish no get better. In love way I get no get weather. No get weather. Yeah. Baby girl, you're my one and only. Yeah. Anything that you want, just holler with me, no way. Yeah. Say I'm your man, your salon, but no. Hey, yeah. Say me mama, don't beat me, pray for you sake, I'm ready for die. Take bullets for you, me, I know they afraid you.
Tell you what, tell you what.
Talk to the news and all over the radio.
Tell you what,
tell only one, you.
Tell you what,
say me too,
you.
A beautiful girl like you, need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Man like me, a beautiful girl like you. Need man,
Need man like me, I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Man like me, because you know go leda. Fish no get better. And the way I get no get weather. No get weather. So, you know go leda. Fish no get better. The love way I get no get weather. No get weather. Baby, you know me, I'm your man, I can be your better man. Baby, you know me, oh. Baby, you know me, your man, I can be a better man. Baby, you know me, no. If you don't want me, I don't understand, but let's take my life away, cause you're the one, my only hope. Baby, you're the one and all. Nothing can separate me from you, no. Oh, baby, yeah. Oh, I'm a little girl like you, need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Man like me, a beautiful girl like you, need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Man like me, because you know to let that. No get better. The love way I get no get weather. No get weather. So I cannot go leather. Fish no get better. The love way I get no get weather. No get weather.
So we go to go, oh. So no matter the gallop, yeah, it's our destiny, oh. So we go to go, oh. If you see your brother, say they progress, no wish and burn.
No wish and burn.
If you see your body, when don't elevate, wish and wear, no. If one you can book or can do, if you want to jump by tongue, nobody today, somebody tomorrow, na so he be, choose your brother. We park on a jealousy. The park knows you want to see. There is anything that you wanna see. Complain, brother. No, they complain. As a super sharp correct driver, you free to overtake. As a super sharp correct rider, be free to overtake. Matter the gallop, reach our destiny, oh. And that's how we go. They go. Say no matter the gallop, reach our destiny. Make you no trouble, my man, get you. Whether you dey enter taxi, dey go. I be you dey drive a Range Rover. See, happiness is a thing of mind, you know. So we go to go.
Na so. Is that yeah? G-O-Y. Yeah. No, be you a carry gun. But now you a go carry go. Sisi a carry go. They take on you, but now you are one and no. Sisi Ferrari, oh.
Yes, that was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed that great music from Africa. And now the Saturday Commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Here is Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure to share my reflections with the audience of the Voice of America. This week, I pay close attention to details and look at events affecting American policy towards Africa. And I also look at African opinions on some attitudes towards the United States. 2 points deserve to be mentioned this week. One is the visit of the Pope to the United States and how that affects U.S. relations to Africa. The second point is the visit of the Chinese president to the United States. We can quickly talk about each one of these two developments. The paper's visit to the United States is very important in the legacy of President Obama, and it also affects his relationship with Africa. Since the time of Abraham Lincoln, papal visit to the United States was a forbidden development in American relations with the world. And many of the historians who look at papal visits to the United States remind us about developments since the Civil War to now. And some historians would remind many Americans that the presidency of Reagan was a turning point in the relationship between America and the Vatican. And of course, since that time, many changes have taken place in America. They have implications for American relations with Rome named the Vatican, and it also has implications for Africa. Because since the time of Reagan, things have developed to the highest level, to the point that there is an embassy for the United States in Rome, and of course, the Vatican is fully represented. Now, this has serious implications for Obama and Africa, because if you look at the presidency of African countries who came here, Africa was represented only by Liberia and Ethiopia before World War I. Liberia was independent, Ethiopia were independent. When independence came to Africa, Kwame Nkrumah was a Catholic president, and then, of course, he was very much welcomed by Richard Nixon, and of course, John Kennedy was a Catholic. When Nkrumah was elected the first president in Black Africa, he was prime minister, this has implications. And of course, here, American policy towards Rome and Accra were very much linked by the Kennedy administration. And so when you look at U.S. relationship with Africa, you can see how the presidency of Kennedy was very interesting development in terms of Kwame Nkrumah coming to the United States as a young president of Africa to the United States. Then you come to another development, American relations with China under Obama. This is an other sensitive area because now the Chinese president himself is very much mindful of this fact. That's why when he was put on the spot, he decided for a scripted narrative by saying the Cold War is over. But the suspicions of the past in America's relations with other countries, going back to the papacy, during the time of Lincoln to now, you can see the most serious wound is between America's relations with China, the days of Mao Zedong, and the Cultural Revolution, and attitudes toward America, and how Nixon changed the game between American relations with China. And when George Bush Sr. was the ambassador of China, we have made significant progress in Chinese-American relations. And American companies are very actively involved in China. The Chinese are now very much involved in Africa. That is why you now have a triangular relationship between the Africans, the Chinese, and the Americans. And this is why Obama's story is triangular. Whether he thinks about it or not, or whether his advisors think about it or not, but most of the analysts who are very much concerned about world history, civilizational relations, cultural relations, interreligious religious relations, will see that under the Obama administration, new frontiers are being made. John Kennedy talked about it when he was president of the United States. New frontiers, going to other countries, other civilizations, other nations, and going to the moon. Today, the next move is to see to it that the Chinese will also be part of the dialogue with the Americans in space, just like we do with the Russians, who were long-term foes of the United States. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight. See you tomorrow Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpoga in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A resurgence of sectarian violence in the Central African Republic, or CAR, raises grave concerns for that country's political transition and respect for the human rights of all its citizens. Many fear that the violence, in which 41 people have died since September 25th, could degenerate into civil war if not contained soon. The international community has been unanimous in its condemnation of the attacks on and among civilians and against humanitarian workers. We have also called for the perpetrators to be brought to justice and appealed for militias to lay down arms now. Meanwhile, more than 1.5 million Central Africans have expressed their wish for a break with the old ways of violence by registering to vote in elections originally scheduled for later this month. It is critical that the elections take place to allow a democratically elected government to lead the citizens of the Central African Republic to lasting peace and recovery. The United States reaffirms its support for the ongoing political transition process and congratulates transitional authorities for recently completing a draft constitution. Gerard Hodel, with the U.S. delegation to the UNHRC, stated, "The Central African Republic has a unique opportunity in the coming months to move decisively toward peace, reconciliation, and justice. Clearly, stopping the violence and seizing that opportunity will be critical for the country's future. The U.S., while encouraged by recent handovers of several hundred child soldiers to UNICEF, remains deeply concerned about the several thousand children who remain in armed groups. The U.S. strongly recommends that the transitional government, with international community support, prioritize their return." The U.S. also condemns attacks by armed groups against humanitarian convoys and peacekeepers and fully supports the effort of the U.N. mission in the Central African Republic and French forces under Operation Sangaré to work with the Central African Republic authorities to reestablish law and order. And we welcome the U.N. Secretary General's pledge to enforce a zero-tolerance policy for U.N. forces who sexually abuse Central Africans, including children. The U.S. is committed to working with transitional authorities and its international partners to help the CAR's transition to a democracy where the rights of all citizens are respected.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.